Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Luke Greenaway, and today I'm joined by the wonderful, the journeyed James Brooksby, Double Six, born ready, edge case, wargaming, and now CEO of Absolute Games. James, how you doing?
All right, thanks very much. Nice to meet you, Luke. Really nice to meet you. Happy to be here.
Oh, fantastic. No, James, obviously the pleasure. The pleasure is all mine. It is frustrating that this is actually a podcast because James and I were just chatting about James's fantastic man cave, and all I can see lined up behind him are like TIE fighters, figurines, Warhammer 40K.
This room is the culmination of many years. I've often been in the shed. There was stuff, as my old colleagues will know, there was things all over the old offices. IKEA shelves full of bits and bobs, and then lots of stuff for my long-suffering wife. And then a couple of years ago, I cleared out the garage, converted it, and then COVID hit. And then I've kind of haven't moved from in here, but I guess we'll get to that later, working from here. But it's been great when people have joined calls because they've gone, oh, you really are quite the nerd. And I'm like, you always wondered about it. And now you know it's true.
I think it's great. I think being a nerd now is cooler than it's ever been.
Oh, absolutely. I think I don't care about, you know, nerd, geek, it's fine. That's what I am. And I'm very pleased and proud about it. I don't care. Not at all.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I'm obviously not to digress too much, but my girlfriend, she always calls me a bit of a geek. And a lot of my friends are like builders or they don't work in the games industry, a lot of them, and they have like important jobs in finance and things like this. And but I love it. I can't think of a better industry to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree with that.
Yeah. And talking of the industry, let's talk about you and your journey, because following your time at uni, your journey in games actually began at Simis. How did that start? How did that come about?
It actually starts before that. It should probably start before that, because my brother, I think my mum and dad got him, it must have been the very late 70s or early 80s, some kind of computer. And he's a couple of years older than me. And he started doing a bit of programming, got into that. And I didn't take any notice for quite a while. I think I was just too busy cycling around on my bike, enjoying life. And then some point in the 80s, he just sort of wanted me to help him. And I used to sit there and read out the things from the magazines. And, you know, we'd sit there and try and work out what was wrong with his programs and so on. And then we'd try and make games, and I'd end up doing the pixel art. So it actually starts sometime in the mid-80s of me sat there with a gridded paper doing cars or caterpillars or aeroplanes or it doesn't matter what it is in 8x8 or 16x16 or something like that. There was no color particularly to it. And then I didn't think about it for ages. And actually, I found out a few years later that, you know, he was selling these games on cassette and making a few quid anyway. And he went on to do a few different games things, and then I'd forgotten all about it for many years. And then it was at uni that, and this is quite a chunk later, I suppose, a good few years later, one of the guys in a house share had an Amiga that was in the middle of the lounge, and then we would sit there and play a few games sort of round robin. Like we'd sit there and move it along, then watch the telly and then move it along. And those things were strategy games quite often as well, or something like that. A game called Empire, and then we had Space Crusade and a few other things like that, you know, on the old Amiga. Anyway, and we had a bunch of different demo discs, and one of them had a 3D art package on it and some of the very early ray tracing stuff. But it was the 3D art package that I just sat there probably skiving off from a couple of lectures I shouldn't have been, or I don't know what I was doing, but ran it up. And it was very much similar to a class that used to exist called technical drawing that I quite enjoyed, that I remembered in school.
Yeah.
Basically, it's, you know, creating a 3D object from three views. So I did it. And then the guys came home from uni and went, that's quite good. That's good, that. Because I made an X-Wing and I made an AT-AT and Starship Enterprise, all geeky stuff, of course. Very happy about that. That's really good. How did you do that? I couldn't do that. It's like, you couldn't do that? It seems pretty easy to me. I could do it. And I carried on doing that for a while. And then it was my sandwich year coming up. And I tried to get, I thought, what are games? I wonder if I could do that. But there was no real jobs in 3D because most games at that point were still sprites and 2D. And they said, could you do sprites? I tried. I was rubbish. Couldn't do them at all. you know, because by then they weren't super simple little no colors in a tiny box. They were pretty complex things. So that was the end of the Sprite era. They were very good. Couldn't do it at all. Couldn't get a job. Didn't matter. I just went and worked at a software marketing company. Learned a bit about exhibitions and shows. But I got the bug and thought, carried on with my degree. And then I was like, right, I'm going to carry on and build up my portfolio and skills over the next couple of years. But still, 3D wasn't that big when I came out of uni quite a few years later. So I did quite like hanging around at uni and enjoying that life for a bit. So I ended up in a flight sim company because they were more 3D, because there wasn't still wasn't that much 3D games. But flight sim companies, yeah, they're because they've been using 3D for a while. Started as a junior artist on a flight sim, you know, making helicopters and trucks and things like that out of very few polygons indeed, and not many colors. But then 3D graphics cards were appearing, so we could do more, and it started to accelerate. And then the bosses, which was really good of them, seemed to recognize quite early that I was a bit bossy, I suppose, and put me in charge of that team. And then Simis became part of Eidos's formation because so Eidos was actually a collection of a number of companies all put together as a group, including publishers and developers. Couldn't remember all of them, but it included Domark, US Gold, Core Design, Silicon Dreams, I think, Simis. I think there's a few more, maybe Deep Red, but all sort of created this group. And then at the same time, Simis was rebadged as Kuju and sort of left behind its flight sim past and became more of a games company. And at that time, we were sort of growing because we got investment, and we went from a mere 13 people and up from that point onwards, actually, and gradually was leading teams as opposed to doing the 3D art over those years.
You mentioned there, like, Kuju Entertainment, like, because obviously I've done my research, but there seems to be, like, quite a lot of overlap between, say, Kuju and some other companies that you worked at during that period, like Double Six. Like, could you tell us about, you know, your time from Kuju Entertainment up to Edgecase?
Oh, crumbs, that's a big load of things. So Kuju was quite interesting because Kuju was pretty small, and got to imagine then at that time there was the intake was all kinds of different people. I mean, programmers were coming through with obviously computer science and maths, but lots of other disciplines like art and the burgeoning design. You've got to remember, there weren't really professional game designers at that stage. So, like, who's a game designer? It's like, well, the coders seem to do it. But then there was actual real, you know, people coming into the industry that said, well, I'll do that and nothing else, and so on. But people coming in from university with all kinds, like if they'd done history or architecture or all kinds of things. And so that was sort of mid-90s as the industry was getting more and more professional, because we're still such a young industry. We're still so young. Still, you know, if you compare to other creative arts who've been around for, well, some of them for eons, we're still so young. Yeah, the company grew really, really well. I mean, we actually, under Eidos, we expanded out, and then actually the directors got a chance to buy back the company quite a few years later and, again, take on investment and grow. Over many years, it grew to well over 300 people in multiple locations from, you know, as I remember it, this, you know, little flight sim company in Godalming. And that, interestingly, there was a point where, you know, like, just Skillford Godalming couldn't handle enough intake. So it's like, well, let's have a London studio. Oh, let's have a Brighton studio. And there's opportunity to do that. And then it was Sheffield, and it was an opportunity to grow. But unfortunately, at one point, we had the Surrey studio, which was called Skillu Surrey, but it was basically in Godalming. We had a big project cancelled, and we'd grown quite well. We were quite a large studio at that point for its time. We had a big project that just got cancelled near the beginning. We had to shrink quite a lot down, but we were working on, at that time, Geometry Wars Galaxies for the Wii and DS, which was a small team within the overall studio. It's like, well, that's still that running contract. That's a good team. And also, I'd been talking to my boss, and, you know, he's very interested in the new world. And it's amazing to even say this, the new world of digital distribution. Because all that time before that, we'd been doing lots of work for hire projects, all kinds of different things, very capable projects on multiplayer and console and all kinds of things like that. But they were all, you know, box product. But there'd been this thing, which was Geometry Wars, of course, and there was XBLA. It's like, well, why don't we build a studio that thinks of nothing else but digital distribution with this small team? You've got a team who are building arcade-like games, and obviously XBLA was more arcade-focused. And let's also see if we can change the business model so that we move away from solid work for hire into something which is more partnerships. If you can go and find people to co-fund these projects so that we can actually own IP or at least share in IP and also the profits. It's like, yeah, that's really exciting. Let's do that. Mm-hmm. That was Double Six. And that was, we moved into Guildford. We took the Geometry Wars Galaxies team and we started to expand that out. And I actually did find people to co-fund games. We still did some work for hire as well, but we blended that all together to create a whole number of different things. The thing that really was our own and was exactly that model was a game called Burn Zombie Burn, which was a top-down arcade shooter, funnily enough, about burning zombies. That did pretty well for us, and that was exactly on that model. And this was super early days for the consoles as well in terms of them understanding for them what digital distribution was. So we were able to, you know, have direct communication with the platforms, especially Sony at that time. We were able to, you know, discuss store promotions and all these kinds of things for free back then, and so on, which was cool. And of course, then Steam was evolving, and there's a lot we could do with Steam as it was growing. Mm. Because again, you know, people forget that digital distribution wasn't always the thing. And actually, there was a surprising amount of people in the early days of Double Six said no. There'll always be more box products. Like, who's going to go and buy stuff online? It's a pain. It's slow.
Yeah.
It won't be forever. And it was a matter of just being at the cutting edge of that.
That's great foresight, though, to be able to see that coming. Because I think at that point, you're right. Like, it's so easy to understate that it just wasn't really a primary distribution platform. It just wasn't considered it at all. I mean,
boxes were it. And, you know, there's some fascinating bits in time across interesting moments, because there was a point where, I'm trying to think where it was, where everybody thought PC gaming was potentially dead. I don't know how many people have brought that up in conversations, but there was a point where you would go into, you know, GameStop, whatever, in the States, and there was about five boxes of PC games and the rest was all console. People said, yeah, it's dead. It'll never recover. Nobody's playing PC. It'll never come back.
Is this back when the boxes were huge? Like,
they are boxes the big ones. Back then, yeah. I'm trying to think what years it was. But there was definitely a bit where it was like, nope, that's it. End of that then.
Yeah.
Which you can't even imagine that's a conversation that people had, but it was for a while.
Yeah. Well, you've got Capcom, who's, I think, only recently said, like, they're obviously predominantly always console. And I think this week they've turned around and said, we want PC to now be our primary platform.
Yeah, which is fascinating, isn't it? So Double Six was interesting. There were some fascinating moments when the smartphones appeared. There's an unfortunately confidential thing that I can't talk about, but like, I had really early insight into some of that, but we did nothing with it. That's the kind of thing where you've got foresight, but sometimes it just fails you and you're like, yeah, no, we'll carry on over here. However, you know, I'm not complaining. It's just because that life brings us to these moments where we are today. So Double Six, we carried on. We, you know, made a whole number of different experiences on those early digital platforms. And then we had the opportunity to do a management buyout of Double Six. And we were in the middle of a contract and co-fund and everything in that model on a game called Strike Suit Zero, which had an investor that would invest in that. And he said, well, I'll help you to, you know, do the management buyout. So we did. And rebranded as Born Ready Games, and then solely focused on Strike Suit Zero. Moved offices into the famous Walnut Tree Close, where it is around here, because there's a story that I'll tell you in a minute. And then we concentrated on that. And again, that was sort of fascinating times, because Steam was still nowhere near as busy as it is today. You know, And when we put the game out, and I tell people this, I think there was two games released that week or something, or maybe two games in that fortnight.
That's mad.
It's like, which is mad, isn't it? And of course, we are all, it was a very small community, so it's like you could have a direct line to Valve and say, oh, you know, a game's coming out, could you do us some promotion? They're like, sure, there's not much else coming out, so, you know, you'll be on the front of store for a while. I'm like, cool, thanks very much, excellent, I really appreciate it. And, you know, people now, you go 140 games in a week sometimes, you go, well, you know, it's just, how do you get that over those discoverability problems. But back then we were so lucky just because of the time it was, right? And also being early on these platforms as well, of course. And that helped Strike Suit Zero be a success. So therefore we were able to then put it onto the next gen platforms, which were then next gen. So that, you know, as the PS4 and the Xbox One came out, and we were quite early on those. And the Xbox One, we were the first independently published game on Xbox One through quite a bit of pain, because this was, that you may have heard of this, the office was flooded because it was the great flood of Guildford in 2013, 14, I'm not sure which year it was, which was mostly people know about it because Hello Games was flooded as well, because we actually were next door to each other. But most people go, oh, Hello Games was flooded. Were you there? It's like, yes, the water came through our office into their office. We were actually slightly closer to the river and it sort of all came through. That was quite the day. It was Christmas Eve. Flooded out the office. It was evil. I mean, if you know Guildford at all, it flooded out quite a lot of the shops, the big department store, restaurants, all kinds. Wow. You know, it was quite something. And again, to happen on Christmas Eve meant that, unfortunately, you know, not everybody was there. And, you know, it was just, I felt very fortunate. There was a couple of people. I'd left at lunchtime, told everybody, it's Christmas Eve, go home. What are you doing? Let's just clear out. Don't worry about the work you've got to do. Let's go home. You know, there was just one or two people said, you know, I just want to finish what I'm doing. And so I was just got home, and then they said, there's water coming in the walls. What can you do? And they said, well, we can move the server. Okay, move the server. What else can you do? You know, they kept phoning back a few minutes later and they'd moved some stuff and said, right, it's now near the power sockets. And I was just, get out, right, leave. And they tried to, you know, we tried to raise some of the offices nearby, and then there's nothing we could do. It's Christmas Eve, Christmas Day the next day, and then Boxing Day. It was a really good spirit because all the businesses turned up and we all helped each other effectively clear out this brown slime from all of our offices, and lots of our equipment was ruined. And
how was your Christmas Day? Because I can imagine.
There was people texting me and going, have you seen the news? Because we didn't know how deep it had got. And then people were going, have you seen the news, how bad it got? I was like, well, if they got that, and I was trying to work out, if it was this bad, this much equipment would be ruined. If it was this bad, this much. And if it was this bad, okay, that's a real problem. We were lucky that our insurance company actually went, no, you're covered, that's good. But there was many who weren't. But yeah, it was a lot of disruption, and we had to jerry-rig the whole office in order to ship, to be the first people to appear. That's why I mentioned the first people on Xbox as an indie publisher. We actually had to put these giant sort of dehydration machines and furnaces downstairs, and then everybody was effectively in the kitchen and the storerooms upstairs with a jerry-rigged network for months whilst the building dried out. But we did it, right? The team did it. They've all power to them. They did it. They shipped the game through some pretty insane odds.
Man, that's crazy. That's so good though. Like, well done to you and the team. You know, like, I've heard of different things holding up projects, but like,
floods. Yeah. Yes. Brown water. I mean, poor Hello next door, because Hello, they weren't there on the day, so they didn't get to move anything. So they actually had a lot of equipment completely destroyed. They had more equipment than us that was ruined because they didn't have anybody in on Christmas Eve. Mm. At least we had some people who managed to move a good few things before it hit. But I lost a lot of my Magic the Gathering collection. I was not happy. And there's a lot of other collectible card games that were on a sort of low shelf. And some really nice art books. And you know, because those things, they just were turned into mush.
You mentioned then being part of, like, you know, the management process for buying out Double Six and basically forming Born Ready. What was that like? Because obviously we do have people come on the show and they talk about, you know, founding their own companies, but we rarely get the opportunity to speak to someone about, you know, actually buying out an existing project.
I'm trying to think how to describe it. I mean, it's not that dissimilar to setting up your company in a way, or combined with a commercial transaction. Obviously, there is, I'm trying to think, what, just going back my brain quite a few years, in fact, pretty much 10 years, there is a lot of making sure that what you're buying is what you're definitely going to get, and there's no strings attached, and so on and so forth. You know, it is similar to a company acquisition process. So there's definitely, if anybody's been through that, there's similarities with that as well. And it's what's important for what was important for me at the time, especially, was making sure that the team felt like this was going to be fine and everything was going to be the same on the other side, you know, or better even, you know, like, when we've done through going through this process, it's going to be better, or like it's business as usual and you won't even have to move desk or, you know, change brand of tea. It's like, it's going to be fine.
Yeah. Quite emotionally challenging in some ways, because I suppose when you found a new company, everyone has the understanding that this is brand new. So there's a bit of leeway and expectations, but if you're buying out an existing like project, essentially you're forming this new company with the management team, were like the devs and the wider team, did you feel like responsible for the success?
Yeah, certainly I would say there was more on my shoulders, because it was moving from somewhat the safety net of a larger company and its departments. So it had a finance department, HR, admin, all these things that suddenly it's like, well, you don't have those. So you need to work out alternative ways of doing it, or do some yourself, and then, you know, get advice on how to run a company. And to be honest, I did make some mistakes, because I hadn't really run. I'd run an independent business unit within a bigger company. But certainly I learned about cash flow pretty quickly. And in fact, I brought on somebody who I'd been working with previously as a COO very quickly. He had more experience in running businesses, and went, have you looked at your cash flow? I was like, no, it's fine. We've got all this. And he's like, no. Now I'll show you how it's done. And then made me a lot of blood rushing away from my brain. Like, oh, God. He showed me how it was done. And then I learned from that point, never just take that for granted. In future. So there's a few important running a real business lessons learned in the very first few days. And of course, that's the other thing about making sure you've raised enough money, so the investors put enough money in to keep us going. And you suddenly become a real businessman, right? And a real entrepreneur and all those kinds of things that I've never looked back, you know, upon, because actually I loved it. You know, I love it. And although there is a lot of stress and so on, I wouldn't have it any other way, probably.
I can imagine it was like you learn a lot. I mean, I know you were there for 6.5 years. I mean, it's actually probably longer, because when you actually think about Double Six and then you think about Kuju, it's almost like a constant evolution.
It is an evolution. And the funny thing is that until recently, it was the same employment contract. And that's the thing that people said, you know, when I'd go to the bank, I'd say, so how long have you been employed? I'd say, well, it's a funny story. And then I'd tell them that basically I had the same employment since 1995. They'd say, well, how's that? Nobody has a job that long. And especially in, you know, creative industries. I said, well, it's because it's always been an evolution. This industry, one of the amazing things is that it's ever changing and it's ever evolving. And there was a small period of stagnation, maybe you could call it stagnation, for a tiny bit, which I think was roughly the late 90s, early 2000s, where there was almost like only 5 game genres. And if you didn't pitch one of those, then that's all anybody wanted, because that's all that mattered and that was it. But most of the time it's been massively changing. And I've had the fortune of just, as everything shifted, I shifted along with it and so on and so forth, which I suppose brings me to what happened next. We did Strike Suit Zero, and that did well for us, and the console did well for us and so on. And then we were looking at what we would do next, and again, looking at where we would go as a company and what was the right thing for us to do. Because you're always thinking a year or two ahead, going, where are we going to go? What are we going to do? Looking at the strategy. And we had a kind of choices. We could either go more mobile, because that was growing and getting big. And you could see that was, you know, it was never going to stop. Or the thing that looked like it was the right place for us was to look at where free-to-play was going and PC free-to-play. So PC free-to-play or mobile, we literally sat down and had that sort of thought. We went, no, mobile's not really, we haven't got a team really for that. That's not where we're going to go. Let's go the other direction. So we were building up designs and ideas whilst Strike Suit was still sort of evolving, because we were doing the console version and so on. And then we sort of pitched that idea out there and got investment for building the next stage of the company, which became Edgecase Games, which is another evolution of Born Ready Games. More investment came on board, rebrand, changed over. There you go. You've now got Edgecase Games. But pretty much everybody was at the same desk. Everybody was at the same desk drinking the same tea the next day. but like, yeah. But it was a new company. And then that allowed us to grow and get more investment. And then we created Fractured Space, which was us using our knowledge of space and space games, but combining it with what we saw in games like World of Tanks and League of Legends, and going, well, there's a space there. And boy, was that a learning process. That was fascinating. We built out the first version of the game really quickly and put it up into early access, just as early access was a bit out of favor for a while, because there was a lot of crap basically being shoved into early access. And sort of we'd gone into early access a bit of bad timing, but we recovered from that quite quickly. We did a free weekend, which blew our socks off. I think we thought, free weekend on Steam, I don't know, maybe 10,000 extra players or something, you know. It'd be lucky if we get that. And I think on the Friday evening, so like 300,000 players turned up.
That's fantastic. Were you it ready?
Broke all the server. No, of course not.
The servers went down.
It broke everything. basically, it was good, but also we shouldn't have done it then. We didn't think it'd be, we just thought it'd be a little bump and then we'll do something big later. But actually, it was an enormous and fantastic marketing boost, but too early, right? The game, we didn't have any tutorial. Most people went, I don't understand how this works, and we could see in our metrics them leaving and all this kind of stuff. And obviously, that was the big, talking of metrics, that was the kind of big change, because we'd gone from a effectively digital distribution where it's like, you're still like a box game and you're putting it out, but it's digital. Whereas moving to free-to-play, we were moving into a live game. We built out we had internal publishing team with community managers, analysts, as we'd had some before, but now all working together as a team every day, thinking about the problem of acquiring, you know, getting players in, keeping players, and then making them satisfied. And then hopefully they'll buy something off us every day. And it took us a while to learn what free-to-play is. Well, there's a number of things, but what free-to-play is all about, which people sort of, you look at them in their eyes when they say, no, I've done free-to-play, and then they pull a little wry smile, because you're making a game, but you're kind of making a machine that looks like a game, and the machine is about optimizing some numbers, and that means that it's the most incredible mix between science, psychology, and game design that you look at on a daily basis or less, right? And we had monitors up in the room with the key numbers on, and you just stand there while you're having your cup of tea every day going, how do we get that number to move up? And then you have long debates about doing something, then you try it, right? Because you can, you're a live game. You go, right, okay, well, next month we'll do this and see what happens. And it moves up. You go, yes. And the next month it moves down. Or the next day it moves back down again. You go, right, well, that wasn't the silver bullet. But also, why did it move down and what happened? And then you try and use the numbers you now have, because you're now live and connected, combined with behavior. And who are these people and why do they behave like that? And what's happened? Yeah. Or maybe it's something random in the world that happened. Absolutely fascinating. And we did that for quite a few years and built a really, really good team that got excellent at that and built, you know, a very good looking game that was very well rated. We got up to 91% rated on Steam.
That's great. Steam can be savage. Steam reviews can be...
People like the game, but it never made enough money to be the money machine. Because it's free, you've got to get over a certain amount of money per person in the game on average, and then you're sustained. But we never were quite there.
You know, you said about, with Edgecase, just before Edgecase became to be, or as Edgecase came to be, you had to make this decision between free-to-play on PC and free-to-play on mobile. Do you look back and think you wish you'd focused on the mobile?
No, not at all, no. I mean, like, you don't know, there's parallel universes. We made Clash Royale or something like that, I don't know. But, like, I think that we made the right decision to go down that route compared to mobile, because the team were those kind of people and so on. And that was the way we were structured. And in fact, not only that, no regrets, because the team got to build the game. We had a fantastic team that got on really well, that built something they were very proud of. And now they're, you know, where they are in the industry and where in various places, and that experience taught them a great deal. So no, I don't regret that. I always sit there and think about what we would have even done. What would we have done? What would we have gone, right, okay, we're going to do mobile. Okay, what's it going to be? And there's so many hiccups. And especially at that time, there was enormous amounts of people putting out mobile games that fell massively flat, right? Because a lot of Western companies didn't even understand how to make money. The big ones were free to play, and it's very hard to know how to do that. And there's a few specialists who understood it. So no regrets.
Oh, good, good. I have to ask you, because at Kuju, you were the executive producer on Fire Warrior. What was this like? Well, I mean, what was it like, you know, working on Fire Warrior at that time?
Yeah, I loved it. There's some very interesting things about that one. It was amazing that we got to do it, that it was quite, you know, a high budget game for its time. The team, we had, you know, ups and downs, and, you know, it was a really good team that worked incredibly hard. There was insane technical challenges. It was really good, and absolutely loved working with Games Workshop and on the IP. It is one of those ones where I'd look back and still there's a little bit of a word of warning, although I do like working on IPs. But there is a little bit of interesting thing there that is potentially not good to work on an IP you love. And I do tell people that sometimes. I go, be careful, because you won't necessarily look at it in the same way. And also, you've got to be careful of the decisions you might make. You might sit there and go, or let's get that gun in, or let's get this in, only because it's not even sane. It's just because you love it, because you love the IP. Same as if you're working on Star Wars or something like, oh, we've got to have that ship in. We've got to have that character in. And you might make a whole bunch of poor decisions because you're not thinking about the game design or the gameplay. You just love the universe, right? So you've got to be careful. But, you know, again, it was fantastic. But it was a period of time that we worked so, so, so hard for so many hours. And it's one of the things which is a regret of mine, is actually the amount of crunch that we did on that game to get it done. One of the biggest problems we had was that we were, again, bleeding edge technology. We were on the PlayStation Network adapter, which was just, it was a piece of hardware that had been only just invented, and we're trying to ship a game on it really quickly, and it had loads. Well, I suppose you couldn't say it had problems. The internet was just not ready for some of the things that we were trying to do, right? Because everybody had quirky modems all over the world, and they're all trying to interface with the game. They caused all kinds of problems, and it was an absolute nightmare.
It was a bit of a watershed moment as well, though, wasn't it, in some ways, because it was a large budget Warhammer 40k project for console. It's interesting because you see the Warhammer license used so much now, actually over the last like 5 years, especially on the PC, but not that much on console for some reason. Why do you think that is?
I mean, Space Marine did really, really well. So do bear that one in mind. That did really, really well. I don't know. There's been constantly people talking back and forth with Games Workshop over the years about all different opportunities. You know, they're still going, right? There's still things being announced all the time. It's a license, right? So you've got to imagine that any company for any license, for any IP, has to make a choice as to whether they're going to do their own brand new amazing IP and keep all the money, or they're going to license something, right? So a long, long time ago, I mean, nearly every game, there was periods where nearly every game seemed to be a license back in the sort of early 90s and things like that, you know, like there was just like everything was.
I remember Cool Spot. Do you remember Cool Spot? Was he? Cool Spot was the 7-Up logo, wasn't it? Is that correct? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And the side scrolling and. Yeah, I remember playing Cool Spot, and everyone was like, this is incredible. And it's like, it's the 7-Up spot. It's the little red circle on 7-Up, and they've turned that into a video game and called it Cool Spot.
and every movie had a game almost that would come out. There'd be all these movie tie-ins, and I remember having people interview, this is before Fire Warrior, going, I'll work with you, but I'm never working on a game license. They had the opinion that all game licenses were rubbish.
Yeah, it was like that, though, wasn't it?
There was a period where it's like, doesn't matter, chug it out, you know, cheap and cheerful. Obviously, we're way beyond that now, but there was a period back years ago like that.
It's interesting that film licenses, game licenses in film, actually went through the same thing, where the majority of films based on video games were shocking. And it's just interesting to see how this like ecosystem like almost reversed now, although game films are getting a lot better.
It's more because it's a cash in on the opportunity. It's not the opportunity. Once it's that, it's like, well, you're the lunchbox and the pair of socks for the movie, and nobody really cares that much. Just get it done, right? Because it's going to make a few extra quid. Either way, either it's whether it's the movie or the game or the game or the movie or the something off the something, it's just a few extra quid. So if people don't have the mindset on making the, you know, quality of care and attention and the budget required to make a good job of it, you'll get what you pay for. And that's often what has happened in the past on things like that, you know, whether it, again, be the movie of the game or the game of the movie or something else similarly linked.
It was interesting because, like, obviously when we were doing our research, looking at getting into you and doing a bit of stalking online, it was interesting to see that there was this Spawn Ready had, like, evolved into Edge Case. There was this constant evolution that you were very much the center of. And then you get to 2018, and so this is, like, 4 years after Edge Case has been created, and obviously you're acquired by Wargaming. Now, I know you can't go into much detail, but can you give an overview at all, like an emotional response about what happened?
Some of it's easy enough. I mean, we created a brilliant team. This has increased, in fact, in recently last couple of years. But actually, we created a brilliant team, and that has value. I'd talk to people about, you know, how it was going and the struggles we were having. People would go, well, you know, maybe you should talk to us about that. You're like, oh, okay, well, what do you mean? I'm like, well, we're growing and, you know, we're looking for good teams. So a number of people were interested in the company as a good team, as a good, solid team that had proven a whole number of things through what it had done over the previous years. And, you know, a lot of that team had been through all of the, well, even a good number of them, all the way back to the Kuju bit before 66, through 66 into Born Ready and Edge Case, right? There's a lot of trials and tribulations, and that has huge value. So, yeah, there's something there where it's like, well, okay, we'd like that. And we negotiated with a couple of parties, and then, you know, Wargaming made a good offer, and it was like, okay, let's do it. That was the end of 2018, made sure the team were all good and all settled. And then by summer 2019, I started to think about what else I might do. And then it sort of leads me to the bit afterwards, which was interesting because I'd been with that team through thick and thin for many years. And then suddenly I was literally in this man cave, as you describe it, in my garage with my toys, thinking about, right, okay, what next? What am I going to do? What am I going to do next? What should I do? And having the luxury, actually, it was weird for a bit. And then I realized it was a luxury to actually have some time to think after years of, you know, of being at the coalface.
I think it's incredible that your career has been this like constant evolution, but with a lot of the same team. And you're looking at 23 years. Well, if you take actually back to the Simis, right? Like,
yes.
Looking at 25 years. I won't ask you too much about obviously leaving Wargaming. I'm more interested in what came next, the Absolute Games. But I will ask like one thing, like emotionally, like, was it challenging?
It is challenging. And I actually spoke to a whole raft of people because I was going through, you know, an emotionally strange moment. I remember chatting to at GDC 2019, with a whole number of people in a bar who I knew were very senior, had been through things, and we were talking about what it feels like. And coming up with very weird metaphors, what somebody said to me, it's like selling your house, but also somewhat also your family, and then other people move in and you're still sat there. And then other people move in and they have things they want to do, right? They're like, oh, well, you know, we'd like to raise your kids like this and we'd like to paint the walls blue and that tree in the garden that where you like to sit, well, that's got to go. And you're sort of like, oh, whereas ordinarily you would move on, right? You would move on. If you imagine you just sold a house, you would be in a new house. You wouldn't be thinking what the people are doing in your house. But in this case, you're sat on the sofa watching it. It's interesting. I talked to a lot of people about that bit where they go from one space to another and what it can feel like. And I think that it's a good experience to have been through that because now, you know, if it were to happen again, I'm fully prepared, right? You're sort of mentally prepared. But if you've not thought about it, I think there's almost like a bit of mentoring counseling that could be done for people who are about to sell their business for the first time, just to say, this is going to happen, but it's fine. That's just what it feels like. Again, because it's your baby. You've made this thing, right? You've made this thing over years, and now you have sold it, but you're still there. Somebody else said it's like, you know, selling your car, but now you're sat in the back. And somebody else is driving it, and you're like, oh, this is unusual.
Yeah, and they could be going to a different destination to the one you're
right.
it sounds horrendous.
it's not horrendous. No, it's part of the way these things work, but it's not the horrendous bit about it is not being ready for something like that, because you've been so busy and you've maybe done all the paperwork and then suddenly it's like, oh, wasn't expecting this emotion, this feeling, because nobody talks about it, because why would they? Because it's not that common. Then you do meet some people in a bar and they go, oh yeah, I remember that feeling. Weird, isn't it? And you go, yes, why did nobody tell me? They're like, I don't know why I would have done. You know, you never asked.
Yeah.
I do try and do mentoring in the industry. I'm helping out some people from Creative England the other day, because I really believe in putting back, by the way, massively believe in putting back. I think, you know, once you have got a few years into the industry, just gradually work out what you can do to help others, because we are really small industry, because you mentioned about how big it is, but actually it's big in success, but it's tiny, tiny, weeny industry. And there's so many people out there who, if you've got a few years, you can just say, look, just ask me some questions. I'll try and put some time aside now and then. I try and put time in my diary, you know, every month to try and help somebody. And sometimes it's been official, sometimes it's been unofficial, but mentor people. And then it does give you the opportunity to help people through these stages, or like say, bear in mind, if you do this, then this could happen. In fact, that one of the things I had the other day in one of these talks I did was people talking about scaling up their businesses and growing and taking on an investment. And I said, you know, very clearly, is that actually what you want? Just because in all the books it says this is the next stage, do take a moment to think about whether that's actually what you want. Don't just go along for the journey. And talk to people about it. Check whether that's it is what you want, right? Because just because you're on this course doesn't mean you have to do it. Because it's you're starting to head down a particular avenue, but it's not that clear at the time when you're at the beginning of it. You need to talk to somebody who's been through it.
Yeah, and I can imagine there's a lot of emotion involved at the beginning. Often, like when you have a lot of emotion, logic becomes diluted, and sometimes you don't think about what's best. You just think about what you know. And I guess I've got to ask you, like, you know, Absolutely Games.
Yeah.
Tell us about Absolutely Games, because that was the next step in your journey.
That's the next step. So basically, you know, like I said, I was sat there thinking, what should I do? And I actually thought, well, maybe I should see whether there's some good jobs out there, and maybe a good job, right? So talked to a couple of people, and there was some good jobs out there. That was true. But actually, that may be worse, interestingly, because like, oh, hold on a minute. So I could do that. So I should do the insane thing and start all over again, which was, you know, I remember sitting there with all the family in the kitchen, and my dad's been in business and been an entrepreneur for years as well. And he's like, I don't know, son, you've been through a lot. Why don't you just go and get a job and let somebody else worry about that stuff? It's like, I don't know whether that's, no, I'm going to do it. I'm just going to do it again. And then some good friends said, you know, let's do this. And then, you know, talk to somebody who said, yeah, well, if you do that, I'll put a couple of quid in. It's like, okay, right. Okay. It starts to all start to come together. And again, with the experience, with the slight insanity, with the bravery or foolishness, and with people behind you, you start to see a picture of something forming. It's like, right. Okay. We could do this. And so started to pull together what would become Absolutely Games. And of course, it's important to think about why you're doing it, what kind of things you're going to be able to do. I can't talk about what we're making at the moment. You know, what would be our first game? We're a games company. What are we going to make? What is our strategy for our games company? Because quite often people start, but they don't think about the strategy. They start making something. But actually, I, again, from experience, thought actually there's a few things that are important in the very first phase that people don't often think about, which is what's our strategy. Also, and a big thing for me, is what are our values? Because actually, one of the biggest things I've learned over all the years is actually how important values and culture are. Because you can just drift through business life and, you know, into your career, and it just happens. You don't notice, and it's fine. It just all happens. But actually, for me, with the various experiences I had and what I've seen, it's like, no, one of the things, very first thing I want to do is say clearly what our culture is, so that we attract the right people for us, the conversation from the very beginning, and that we build the kind of team that I'd like to see. Right? and I'd like to work with, because at the end of the day, you've got to go to work enjoying it. So, you know, I want to enjoy the people that I work with. So it's like, right, okay, well, one thing's really clear, because some things that I've decided I really don't like, I've seen it around in the industry or other, you know, elsewhere as well in business, is politics, basically, company politics, complete nonsense, right? I understand how the bigger and bigger you get, the more chance of it creeping in it is, but for the longest time, let's just keep it out. And, you know, we put it on our website, we put it on our job ads, because we went that far to say, no politics, no bullshit. If I can say that on your podcast.
Yes.
That's just going to be our part of our motto, right? Because I want people to be open, honest, enjoy what they're doing, not feel in any way there's somebody going to come up and get them, or that they're not going to be able to say what they think. They have to worry, or they feel bullied, or any of these things, right? There's all those kinds of nonsense that comes in with that. Because actually, at the end of the day, what do I want to do? What do I want everybody thinking about doing? Is making games, right? It's making, that's what we're here to do. It's what nearly everybody in this industry joined to do. But there are people who, it's not what they joined to do. What they joined to do is to feather their own nest and become powerful. It's like, okay, good for you. Do that elsewhere. Do that somewhere else. You could be very successful, and that's fine, but not with us. And if that's going to push people away that could help us, it just is, right? It just is, because that's what we've decided is our is important part of our values and culture, combined with us saying Absolutely Games will be a strategy and strategic gaming company. So that's quite a vast area, but, you know, that's this, that's the genre area. We will build strong communities, because one of the things I learned through, especially once we started that Strike Suit Zero and then into Edge Case and Fractured Space, is how important community is. Because again, that didn't used to be a thing. It's amazing to think that there was no connection at one point, and then there was.
Yeah.
And so on. It's funny, because people go, well, of course, everybody always talked to each other. It's like, no. How would a developer talk to a consumer in the late 90s? It's like, it's impossible. So community and how important that is. Obviously, we're not announced yet, so we haven't got a community yet. But that when we go, then community, and then longevity. So making games with long, long tails. We actually used to do GDC talks on making more money than you imagine after your game's launched, because most people went, well, the graph does this, like, drops off, like, and that's it. You can't make money after a game's launched. Like, well, our game did this, and they go, that's impossible, and I'll explain how. And then keep that sort of philosophy of what we learned from the free-to-play game, so in Fractured Space, on building effectively so games as a service type model, but making these games have a long tail, and then all those things combined, in my opinion, and again, you sort of lose it to the room I'm in, is hobby. Right? So I think that builds hobbies. And people, when their game becomes their hobby, that's it. They talk about it, they love it, they think about it. And then you've got an audience that wants to know what you want to do next or how you're going to expand what you're doing. And so let's build games that become people's hobbies. And that's that strategy piece combined with the values. And that's what Absolutely Games is. And, you know, it was me in my garage. Then it became sort of two, then three, then five. And then last year we were eight all through the pandemic. That was fun. Now we've got a fantastic publisher that we're working with that we signed up at the end of 2020. And then this year we've grown from eight at the beginning of the year, and we're now over 20 and growing with, you know, fantastic opportunities ahead of us, you know, and we've stuck to our values. We've stuck to our strategy.
I think it sounds fantastic. I love that culture. And therefore, like, the people are at the forefront of, you know, what you're trying to create.
I'll tell you what I got excited about last night. I know it's not new news, but, like, I actually saw the video for the first time of Advance Wars 1 and 2 redone on the Switch. And I actually just sit there with just a big smile, because I was like,
really?
Just thinking about the billions of hours I lost playing Advance Wars when they first came out. That they were like, well, I'm getting that.
I think, yeah, Advance Wars is fantastic. I think, I didn't know they'd redone them. I haven't actually got a Switch, sadly.
You'll probably do a little smile.
I loved Advance Wars. Game Boy Advance, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. But they were all through Game Boy Advance and then eventually onto DS, and yeah.
Is Absolutely Games the end game? I mean, what can we expect from you? No way.
I mean, my father is still working and he's 80, right? And he's still give up work. I don't want to give up work. It is an interesting thing about, because the games industry is so young, is like, what are the older people in the industry going to do? How does that reflect? How does that work with, because we want to have so many much younger talent coming in. How does that mix as we get to become, you said veteran, you know, like that doesn't mean a bit older, but like you become whatever the next thing is after veteran. Like, how does that all work? So I want to keep on going. And there is much, much more in this brain, although I do keep forgetting things more. You'll find that out one day. But there is so much more going on up there that we could do. And, you know, the talent around that can deliver on that and bring new ideas, new thoughts to the table. There's just so much out there. And again, because people come to this industry with huge passion, to find those passionate people and build games together. The biggest problem we've got at the moment is actually that the industry is doing so well, partly because we did so well because of the pandemic, because everybody's sat at home playing games. And we found out that we're an industry that can carry on making games pretty much with very little impact from home, which is probably a whole nother conversation, that actually we're really doing well, but we can't get that many people. We need more people to come into the industry to fill the slots. The balance of power has changed over the years. It's not just about publishers publishing in the same way it used to be. And in fact, you know, in my last 2 years, we had an internal publishing department, and maybe we will again at some point, and absolutely as well, because actually you can self-publish and it's entirely viable. Harder than it used to be, as I was saying, there's not just two games a week on Steam anymore. But maybe that's something that we'll revisit at some point.
Those days, two games on Steam, fortunately. The last thing I just wanted to ask you to like cap off by this, and it's been a great, I obviously loved having you on, it's been a great chat. I would love for you in like one sentence to just summarize your career so far.
Oh, crumbs. So the career so far has been what I hoped it would be. It has been filled with wonderful people, full of passion. I've worked with some amazing people. It's ever changing. It will ever change. Full of opportunity. I have been very lucky, very fortunate. And, you know, a lot of that's to do with the teams and people I've had around me and the friends and colleagues and shareholders and whoever I've met along the way who've been brilliant. And again, one of the things about this industry is get out there and meet people, because there's a lot of people who will support you and lift you up and help you along your way.
That's great. That was a great response. Well, and on, you know, that wonderful note, James, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, you know, for taking the time and actually coming in.
Yep, you're more than welcome, Luke. And, you know, like I said, I do like talking about this industry because it is just so great. So happy to do this anytime.
The comments of James and my own are our own and do not represent those of our employers. And if you want to get in contact with us, it's gamedevshow@ptw.com. Till next time, thank you again, James. Yeah, I hope I'll see you soon.
You're welcome.
Game over.